I'm particularly pleased to be able to introduce to you Professor David Lewis from Princeton University, who's currently distinguished visitor to La Trobe University in the philosophy department. And David will need a little introduction to many of you, but I will mention one or two things for those of you who don't know him. He's been a professor of philosophy at Princeton University for some time. He's the author of two books, a book called Counterfactuals and a book called Convention. He's visited Australia on several occasions in the past and has visited this department briefly in the past. And the philosophers at La Trobe have developed a relationship with him, we'd like to think, which we regard as being philosophically close and also particularly friendly. We're particularly pleased to have Professor Lewis here, not only because he's a most eminent philosopher and one for whom we have the utmost respect, but because he is one that we can talk to and we learn a lot from him in the process. I hope that you'll share this experience this evening. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. Professor Lewis.
Thank you. They say that experience is the best teacher and that the dusty classroom is no substitute for real life. This could mean all sorts of things, many of them false and many of them true. But there's one thing in particular along these lines that I think is true and important and potentially a threat to philosophical positions I'd like to hold. One thing it's a potential threat to is materialism or physicalism, this being the doctrine that physics, if not today's physics, some sort of theory along more or less the same lines, can reasonably be expected to give a complete and comprehensive description of the world, including the mental part of the world. The other threatened view, which is independent of materialism, is the view that there's no sort of contingent fact about the world which is, in principle, inaccessible to scientific investigation, by which I mean investigation that proceeds by observing effects and hypothesizing about their causes and testing these hypotheses by seeing what further effects they predict and whether those effects show up. I think there's a version of the notion that experience is the best teacher, which is a threat to these views. So I want to defend them against it. Not by rejecting the premise, which I don't think is an honest live option, for me anyway, but by looking for a way to interpret the premise so that it isn't any threat. Right. In the United States, we have an animal called a skunk, which I believe doesn't exist here in Australia. The skunk defends itself by chemical warfare. When it feels attacked, it sprays a foul-smelling liquid, which is rather persistent. Thus, patches of the scent stay around for quite a while afterwards. The skunk often feels attacked by cars on country roads. Therefore, drivers on country roads often have the opportunity to smell the lingering scent of the skunk. I've smelled this scent quite often, and therefore I know what it is like to smell a skunk. Since most of you have mostly lived in a country where there aren't any skunks, I think probably most of you haven't had this experience. And therefore, I think that most of you don't know what it's like to smell a skunk. And you never will, unless someday you go where the skunks are and you smell a skunk for yourself. Conversely, in this country, there's a substance called Vegemite, and probably most of you have tasted Vegemite. And you know what it's like to taste Vegemite. I haven't tasted it, and I don't know what it's like, and unless someday I taste some Vegemite, I never will know what it's like. Now, it won't help you at all in knowing what it's like to smell a skunk, and it won't help me at all in knowing what it's like to taste Vegemite if we take a course of lessons on the chemical composition of skunk scent, or the chemical composition of Vegemite, and on the physiology of the nostrils or of the taste buds, and on the neurophysiology of the sensory nerves and the brain. None of that will do anything at all toward helping either of us know what it's like to have these experiences we haven't had. Further example, due to Frank Jackson, I'll call it the example of the captive scientist. A brilliant scientist has lived from birth in a cell, a prison cell, where everything is black or white, or maybe shades of gray. Maybe the scientist herself is covered in a white coverall, or maybe they come in the night with paint. Anyway, no exception. She looks at the world on television. For instance, but it's black and white television. For instance, she watches the result of many scientific experiments conducted under her direction. She sends her assistants wherever she wants them to go and tells them what experiments and observations they are to perform. She reads books and journals on television, or perhaps they make black and white copies and give them to her. Using two-way television and telephones, she joins in scientific discussion, as it were, attends scientific conferences, and so forth. In this way, she becomes the world's leading expert on color and on color vision and on the brain states that are produced by colors. She knows exactly what reflection spectra or wavelengths of light produce what effects on the eye, which in turn produce what effects on the brain, which in turn produce what effects in verbal and other behavior. And she knows a great deal, far more than anyone here is likely to know, about which things emit light of which wavelengths. And she has a sideline in theoretical semantics, knows just what and putting together the physics and the semantics, she knows just what properties of things are denoted by the color words and by the color experience words, and what general linguistic rules and conventions there are in virtue of which those words denote those things. I don't say she understands the words. That's another and a harder question. I don't think we'll need to settle that question. Right. But for all that, she doesn't know what it's like to see color. and she isn't going to know what it's like to see color unless she gets out of her cell, where the colored things are, and has the experience of seeing color. Final case, the bat, perhaps the most famous instance of the problems I'll be discussing, though I think not the first or the most clearly presented. Nagel rather runs a number of separate issues together. If you want a really clear account of the matter, I would like to refer you to the paper by Frank Jackson, which I've put on the board, but until it's published, I'm not sure I can. Well, if you're interested in reading further, watch out for that paper. Anyhow, the case of the bat. The bat is an alien creature. I don't mean from another planet, but for a creature of this planet, it's pretty alien. With a sonar sense, which is quite unlike any sense that we have. We can never have the experience of a bat, for we couldn't become bat-like enough to have those experiences without ceasing to be ourselves. And even if I could turn you into a bat, all we'd have then would be a bat having bat experiences. We wouldn't have a human who has done this difficult thing and found out what it's like to be a bat, because you wouldn't be human anymore. We'll never know, therefore, what it is like to be a bat. Not even if we come to know all the facts there are about the behavior of bats and the behavioral disposition of bats. Not only what bats do, but also what they would have done if put into all sorts of alternative circumstances that they never were put into. And not even if we come to know all the facts there are about the bat's physical structure and the physical processes that go on in a bat. I don't mean just the gross anatomy, but the cell-by-cell anatomy, and eventually the molecule-by-molecule and the quark-by-quark anatomy. And not even if we come to know all the same sorts of physical facts about other bats, or about other creatures, or about ourselves. And not even if we come to know all physical facts whatsoever, the complete physical description, electron by electron and quark by quark, of our world over the whole of space and the whole of time, together with all the probabilities, all the laws, all the causal relations, all the hypothetical facts about how things would have been if they had been somehow different. And not even if we became able instantly to recognize each and every mathematical or logical consequence of the facts we know, no matter how complicated. That would be a course of lessons indeed, but it wouldn't be enough to enable someone who isn't a bat and can't have the experiences of the bat to know what it's like to be a bat. So, experience is the best teacher in the following sense, whatever other senses it may or may not be true in. Having an experience is the best way, very nearly it's the only way, of coming to know what that experience is like. Qualifications. You can come to know what an experience is like by having very similar experiences and then extrapolating or interpolating. But that's coming to know what one experience is like by coming to know what another experience is like. Taking it into account won't change anything, and I'm not going to fuss about it. Second qualification, maybe you would know what an experience is like if, by magic or by surgery, the very same changes were produced in your brain that would have been produced by the experience if you'd had it. Maybe that would be a way of coming to know what an experience is like without having the experience. All the same, it's close to true that the only way to know what an experience is like is to have the experience, and certainly lessons won't do it. No amount of scientific information about the stimuli that produce the experience, no amount of information about the process that goes on in you when you have that experience, no amount of scientific information of any other kind you please will enable you to know what it's like. Now, I think some materialist, naming no names, might try to resist this conclusion as follows. A materialist might say, knowing what it's like when so-and-so happens means knowing what experiences one has when so-and-so happens. For instance, knowing what it's like to drive a steam locomotive on an express train means knowing what experiences a locomotive driver has. Physical information does so answer the question. The bat's experience of detecting a bug by sonar is the state that occupies such and such a role in the bat's functional organization. I mean by that if we tried to characterize the states of the bat in an abstract way, as we might try to characterize the states of a computer if we had software knowledge but not hardware knowledge, by saying which combinations of states and inputs cause which combinations of states and outputs, then if we knew enough about the bat, we could characterize the bat's experience of detecting a bug by sonar by its place in that causal network. And besides, if we had enough physical information, we could also answer the question on a hardware level. We could find out exactly which state it is that turns out to be the one that occupies such and such a role in the bat's functional organization. It turns out to be the one consisting of so-and-so pattern of firing of the bat's neurons. That's what the bat's experience is. We can refer to the bat's experience both in an abstract way in terms of functional role and in a more detailed way in terms of its physical realization. Right. Having that experience is what it's like to be a bat. I've told you what experience the bat has, and now you know what it's like to be a bat. Well, that's wrong. I accept the materialist's premise that experiences are definable by functional role in physical realization. That's a long story. I'm not going to tell it properly here. But I don't accept the conclusion that we know what it's like to be a bat when we know enough about the bat's functional organization and the states that occupy the roles. I do accept the conclusion that physical information tells us what experience the bat has. Yes. But it wasn't right to say at the start, knowing what it's like when so-and-so means knowing what experience one has when so-and-so. That's not enough. To know what it's like when so-and-so, we must not only know what experiences one has when so-and-so, but also we must know what it's like to have those experiences. Right, I can tell you what it's like to be an engine driver if I can tell you what experiences the engine driver has, provided you know what it's like to have those experiences. And probably you do. And if I know enough, and if materialism is true and I know enough bat physics, I can tell you what experience the bat has. But this time you won't know what it's like to be a bat because you won't know what it's like to have those experiences. So though I too am a materialist, I don't think this materialist way of turning aside the problem is any good. Right. Part two. There is a natural and tempting explanation of why it is that physical information about an experience doesn't help us to know what the experience is like. This explanation is the hypothesis that as well as physical information, there is an irreducibly different kind of information to be had. Call it phenomenal information. The two kinds of information are independent. Two possible cases might be exactly alike physically, yet they might differ phenomenally. Physical information won't separate the cases. Phenomenal information will. When we get physical information, we narrow down the physical possibilities. And maybe we narrow them down all the way to one if we have the sort of utopian physical information that I imagined us having about the bat. But we leave open a range of phenomenal possibilities. When we have an experience, we acquire phenomenal information. Possibilities previously open are eliminated, and that is what it is to learn what the experience is like. That is what I call the phenomenal information hypothesis. That is the thesis that I don't like and want to dispose of. I can't refute it, but I shall argue first that it is a stranger idea and a less tempting one than it may at first seem, and then second, I shall argue that we are not forced to accept it since there is an alternative hypothesis available. The sense in which experience is the best and almost the only teacher when it comes to knowing what an experience is like doesn't have to be captured by the hypothesis of phenomenal information. I will suggest that it can instead be captured by an alternative hypothesis, which, as you see, will turn out to be called the ability hypothesis. Now, what's strange about the hypothesis of phenomenal information? 3 points. First, some of you may have thought all along that physical information was inadequate to explain the phenomena of mind. You may have been convinced all along that the mind can do things that no physical system ever can do. That it can bend spoons, or it can invent new jokes, or it can prove the consistency of arithmetic, or it can reduce the wave packet, or whatever. You may have been convinced that the full causal story of how the deeds of mind are accomplished must be a story that involves the causal interaction not only of material bodies but also of astral bodies. Not only the vibrations of the electromagnetic field but also the good or bad vibes of the psionic field. Not only protoplasm but ectoplasm. I doubt this. I think as a bet on the adequacy of scientific theories, the thing to do is to bet on a winner to go on winning. But maybe you think that in dealing with certain phenomena, perhaps some of those I listed or perhaps some other ones, the former winner has already lost beyond hope of recovery. Well, never mind. This question about what an adequate, complete scientific theory should look like, is irrelevant to our topic. And there is no joy for you in what I have said. You and the physicalist are in the same boat. Suppose it's all true. Every such hypothesis that ever was proposed in all of California and more besides. Let parapsychology be defined as the science of all the non-physical entities, all the causal processes, all the non-physical entities, all the non-physical causal processes, all the non-physical laws of nature, and so forth, that may be required to explain the things that we do. Not to mention all the causal processes and laws and so forth that govern the interaction between the physical and the non-physical part. If the non-physical part is required to explain things we do, like tell novel jokes, of course, the non-physical part will be in part explaining occurrences in the physical part. Out of the physical mouth come the physical noises. They constitute a novel joke. If it takes some sort of non-physical system ever to invent a new joke, then this non-physical system has to interact with the physical mouth. Okay, let's suppose that we learn ever so much parapsychology. Let's suppose it's all true, and we manage to formulate it precisely and confirm it experimentally. It makes no difference at all to what I've said. The captive scientist may study the parapsychology as well as the psychophysics of color vision, and she still won't know what it's like. Lessons on the aura of Vegemite will do no more for me than lessons on its chemical composition, if indeed it has an aura which is important to the way it tastes. And so it goes. My point is that the intuitive datum we started with wasn't just that physics lessons couldn't help the inexperienced person to know what it's like. The starting point was that lessons couldn't help. Lessons can't help because they're just talk. They don't include getting the experience, and short of irrelevant exceptions, that's the only way. If there is such a thing as phenomenal information, it isn't just independent of physical information. It's independent of any sort of information whatever that can be served up in lessons for the inexperienced. So, an argument for phenomenal information isn't just an argument for parapsychology. It's an argument for something much stranger. That was my first reason for disliking the hypothesis of phenomenal information. Here's the second. When the captive scientist is released, her jaw drops. She says, "At last I know what it's like. By its shape, this stuff must be grass. So this is what it's like to see green." Afterwards, she can do things she couldn't before. For instance, she can say which one of a batch of color chips is the green one. One might have thought that she said what she did and acquired the ability that she did because she came to know what it's like to see green. One might have thought that. But it isn't so if the hypothesis of phenomenal information is right. For suppose the phenomenal facts had been otherwise, so that she acquired different phenomenal information. Or suppose that the phenomenal aspect of her experience had been missing altogether. The phenomenal aspect being the aspect which is the alleged subject matter of phenomenal information, whatever that may be. Would that have made the slightest difference to what she said or did, then or later? I think not. For if the phenomenal aspect makes any difference to the noises out of the mouth, or if it makes any difference to the motions of the jaw, these being physical phenomena, then we can describe the phenomenal aspect partially by its physical effects. And that will enable us to give lessons on it to the inexperienced. But whenever we can give lessons on it to the inexperienced, then it won't be the alleged unique subject matter of phenomenal information. Phenomenal information is something you can't get knowledge of by being given lessons and not having the experience. So, if the alleged phenomenal aspect plays any causal role in regard to the physical that would enable us to give lessons on it, then it isn't the phenomenal aspect after all. Now, here things get a bit complicated. We might say there are coarse and fine distinctions in the phenomenal world. Take all the possible ways the world may be. Divide them up by physical differences. So that all these cases are physically just alike, all these cases are physically just alike, and so forth, but any case in one cell differs physically from any case in any other. Right. Now, my opponent thinks that there are some finer differences to be made, namely, phenomenal differences. That is, we can subdivide the physically similar cases into phenomenally different ones, so that by finding out which white cell you're in, you haven't yet found out which pink cell you're in. Now, suppose that my opponent thinks that some phenomenal differences influence the motions of the jaw and the vibrations of the air in front of the mouth, as they must if the phenomenal realm causes the remarks that seemingly occur after and because of a first exposure to something new in the phenomenal realm. Well then, I could have described the phenomenal possibilities by saying in advance, by saying what physical effects they would cause, and I could have told the captive scientist in advance which phenomenal possibility was the right one, namely, it's the one that causes such and such effects. But maybe only the coarse aspects of the phenomenal differences have physical effects, and the finer ones don't. Maybe there is a further subdivision. I won't subdivide all along. Please do imagine further subdivisions all over the place. So, on this compromise view, the really ineffable part, the part that you can really come to know only by having the experience, is which of the green subdivisions you're in. Well, let's just turn the pink lines white. If the part that can be, the part that isn't ineffable, the part that's describable by its causal role in influencing the physical isn't part of what I call phenomenal information. The problem arises all over again about the differences between possibilities that are marked by the green lines, and then I say all over again, these differences have nothing to do with the behavioral effects that you might have thought were caused by discovering which of the green cells you're in. They would have been just the same if it had been a different one. That is my second objection. Third, information is a matter of the elimination of possibilities. If you lack information, several possibilities are open. And when you get the information, some of those alternatives are excluded. The information you get can be thought of as the information that the possibility that's realized is one of these ones, not one of those ones. Now, mathematical and logical information, if there is such a thing, might turn out to be an exception. And that's annoying, given a general account of information in terms of possibilities. But at any rate, if it is an exception, it's a completely irrelevant exception. It's plain that when you get to know what it's like to smell the skunk, you don't do it by getting better at mathematics and logic. If there is any such thing as mathematical and logical information which can't be explained in terms of excluded and admitted possibilities, that's not the same thing as this mysterious phenomenal information. But when we don't know what it's like to have an experience, where are the alternative open possibilities? I cannot present to myself in thought a range of alternative hypotheses about what it might be like to taste Vegemite. I can't imagine 7 different tastes unlike anything I ever tasted before and wonder which one it is. I cannot imagine either what it is like to taste Vegemite or any alternative way that it might be like, but in fact isn't. With the exception of the hypotheses that it might taste just like something I'm already familiar with. But I've been authoritatively told this very afternoon that that isn't so. The only thing that tastes anything like Vegemite is something called Marmite, and I've never tasted that either. So I cannot even pose the question that phenomenal information is supposed to answer. I can't pose the question, is it this way or is it that way? Now you might think that while I can't pose the question beforehand, I can afterwards. Afterwards, I can think of a range of alternative possibilities, and I can say, it turned out to be this way. Maybe I'd better taste some other new things, too. Here are 7 new experiences, and it turns out that what it's like to taste Vegemite is this one of them, not any of the other ones. This is something like the thought that, when we see red, we have one experience, call it experience one, and when we see green, we have another, call it experience two, but it might possibly have been that when we see green, we have experience one, and when we see red, we have experience too. There are the alternative possibilities. Well, I don't think that will do the trick. I agree that there are those alternative possibilities, but it seems to me we can explain these alternative possibilities without any phenomenal differences between physically, or as it might be, parapsychologically, similar cases. something goes on in me when I see red things, something else goes on in me when I see green things. That's uncontroversial. Whatever you think goes on in you when you see red things and when you see green things, and whether or not there's a phenomenal aspect to it, it's at any rate true that something goes on in you when you see red things and something goes on in you when you see green things. Now, I think that we, roughly speaking, that we can define the experience of seeing red as that which goes on in you when you see red things, the experience of green as that which goes on in you when you see green things. If so, then there is certainly a possibility that the experience that goes on in you when you see red things, in fact, might have rather been the experience that goes on in you when you see green things. Or if it's correct to define experiences in the way suggested, that the experience, that which is actually the experience of red might have been the experience of green instead. That's a possibility, all right, and I think it's, and it seems fair to call it the possibility that red might have produced a different experience from the one it actually does, but it seems to me I've given an account of this difference of possibilities without ever needing any phenomenal differences. So, if there are alternative possibilities for the phenomenal aspect that cut across the physical and the parapsychological, if such there be, then they are something else. So I still can't find them. To sum up the case against the phenomenal information hypothesis, I say again, it's a case that the hypothesis is strange and peculiar, not a case that refutes it decisively. Phenomenal information is strangely isolated from all other sorts of information, and it is so regardless of whether the mind works on physical or parapsychological principles. Phenomenal facts have nothing to do with explaining why people seemingly talk about phenomenal facts. For instance, they play no part at all in explaining the movements of the pens of philosophers writing treatises about their introspective acquaintance with phenomenal facts. Further, phenomenal information is almost unique in the way it resists treatment in terms of the elimination of alternative possibilities. It would be nice, and not only for materialists, if we didn't have to believe in it. And we don't. Three, the ability hypothesis. If you have a new experience, smell the skunk or taste the Vegemite, you come to know what it's like, whatever that means. But that isn't the only thing that happens. You also gain abilities. You can recognize the experience if you have it again. You can remember having it. You can imagine having it. And you can also imagine having related experiences that you never did have. Tasting Vegemite ice cream, for instance. By performing imaginative experiments, you can predict with some reliability what you would do in circumstances that have never arisen. Or if they're going to arise tomorrow, then you have a way of foretelling the future, which isn't open to you if you don't know what the experience is like. Perhaps you can predict that you'd ask for a second helping of Vegemite ice cream. I can't say, not knowing what it would be like. These are abilities that you can't gain, barring magic or brain surgery, except by having the experience that imparts them to you. And in particular, you cannot get these abilities by taking lessons on the physics or the parapsychology of the experience in question, or even by taking comprehensive lessons that cover the whole of physics and parapsychology. And I don't just mean the whole of the part that's known today. I mean the whole truth in those subjects. My hypothesis is that knowing what an experience is like just is the possession of these abilities to recognize and remember and imagine. It isn't the possession of any kind of information, ordinary or peculiar. It isn't the knowledge that certain possibilities are unrealized. It isn't knowing that, it's knowing how. An old distinction in philosophy, going back at least to Gilbert Ryle, but I think just the medicine for the present problem. There are plenty of parallel cases. Some people know how to wiggle their ears. Other people don't. And if you can't do it, no amount of information will help. Some people know how to eat with chopsticks. Others don't. If this is like an academic audience at home, it's probably about 50-50. Information will help up to a point. For instance, if your trouble is that you hold one chopstick in each hand, but no amount of information by itself will bring you to a very high level of know-how. Some people know a C-38 locomotive by sight. Others don't. If you don't, it wouldn't help, or at least it wouldn't help much, if you memorized a detailed description in geometrical terms of its shape. Its shape is regular enough that you could describe it in geometrical terms, and the description would be short enough to memorize if your life depended on memorizing it. But it wouldn't help you recognize one. It wouldn't help you much. It would help you some. For instance, you could recognize from the geometrical description that some parts of it are high up and hemispherical, and you could eliminate some candidates on that. But you wouldn't get the gestalt. That would be something else. Conversely, knowing the shape by sight doesn't enable you to write down the geometrical description. I know the shape by sight, but in order to write down the geometrical description, I'd really have to measure one, or take a photograph and measure that, or draw shapes at random until I got it right, and then measure the drawing I'd made. Information doesn't suffice for know-how. Information contributes to know-how in most cases, but it often doesn't contribute enough. That's why music students have to practice. Of course, there are some aspects of ability which are not in any sense knowledge. Some aspects Of course, there are some aspects of ability which are not in any sense knowledge. Some aspects of ability are not knowing that, they aren't possession of information, and they aren't knowing how either. For instance, strength. Nobody who once knew how to, some athletic feat, fails to know how by when he loses his strength. Sufficient funds for another. If you lose your money, there are things you're no longer able to do, but you haven't stopped knowing how to do anything that you knew how to do before. And of course, some aspects of ability are purely and simply a matter of possessing information. If you want to know how to open the combination lock at the bank, information is all you need. It remains that there are aspects of ability that we do call knowledge and that do not consist simply of possession of information. I suppose, roughly, skill. It isn't just a pun. Even if there are two distinct senses of the word know, a knowing how sense and a knowing that sense, these senses are closely related and they are well and truly entangled. We do so often gain information and ability together that perhaps the pure cases of one or the other are the exception. If so, it should be no surprise if we apply to both sorts of pure cases the same word that we apply more commonly to the mixed cases.
In fact, the mixture is more complicated. There's a third element to the mixture, acquaintance. Father can't get to know Lloyd George, for Lloyd George died before Father ever had the chance. No amount of information will do the trick. Father may be an extremely thorough biographer, and the archives may be very complete. Is there some special information about someone that you can only get when you're in his presence? Know-how won't do it either. Father may be very good at imagining Lloyd George, seemingly remembering him, recognizing him. Incidentally, the ability to recognize is something that could exist even though the one to be recognized is dead and gone. Because Father, after studying photographs, has the ability to recognize Lloyd George, then if he were to turn up, returned from the dead, Father could indeed tell that it was him. Likewise, I believe that I possess the ability to recognize certain classes of locomotives that all went to the scrapyard long before I was born. I get it by looking at pictures. Again, it isn't a pun. It isn't just that knowing sometimes means possessing information and sometimes means having the skill to do things, mental things or others, and sometimes means being in the presence of, in the way that a bank sometimes means a maneuver by an airplane and sometimes means a gradient on the railway. Meeting someone, gaining a lot of information about him that would be hard to gain in any other way, gaining abilities regarding him, usually go together. The pure cases are the exceptions. They're possible, and the possibility of pure cases was what made our problem. How can it be that no amount of information would enable you to know what it's like to be a bat or to smell a skunk? All the same, just because the mixed cases are common, you shouldn't be surprised if the same word applies to pure cases that are pure instances of one element of the mixture and pure cases that are pure cases of another. So in short, I propose there's no special, isolated, phenomenal information. Again, I say this is neither here nor there on the question of whether there's a special kind of parapsychological information. That's a separate question on which I also have views, but they're irrelevant to our topic. Rather, there are abilities. No materialist needs to be in the least embarrassed if it turns out that gaining a lot of information isn't a way of gaining abilities. Why should it be? Suppose you have a device which works like this. It has two parts. One part is a large repository of information. It is a sort of a smart data bank, one that is capable of pulling things out in answer to questions, and one that's capable of doing a certain amount of reasoning about what's there explicitly so as to find things that are there implicitly. But this gadget does something else too. It's a pattern recognizer. And the way it works as a pattern recognizer is when you present it with a certain instance of a pattern, it prepares a matching template. And when you present it with future patterns, it takes out its template and tries it on to see if it fits. And also, perhaps, it can get out its template and do things with it even when there isn't a new pattern to be tried out. Perhaps some of the same machinery is used in the data bank part and the pattern recognizer part, maybe the same central processor, or maybe not, who cares? Now, a machine which is a combination smart data bank cum pattern recognizer, something like a combination calculator and electric alarm clock, might be given a third capacity. It might be possible to fix it up so that in addition to doing the two things that I said it could do, it could also build templates for the pattern recognizer part out of the information stored in the data bank part. But that would be a new third ability. It's no part of the two abilities that I already said it had. Perhaps we're like that. Perhaps we're like the machine that has a data bank part and a pattern recognizer part with templates, but has little or no power to make templates for the pattern recognizer part on the basis of the information in the data bank part. Well then, it would be a mistake to say that the templates are after all part of the data bank, but they're a very strange part used for storing data of a very strange kind that can't ordinarily be put there. There's a sense in which they contain information, something more like the usual information theoretic sense than I've been using. But you don't exclude any more possibilities about the way the world is by having an extra template available than you did before. So, in summary, it's true that there are things that you can learn from experience, but not from lessons. That can't be denied. But the knowledge is know-how. It isn't possession of information. And therefore, it is quite unnecessary to believe in a very strange sort of information which it's the possession of. Do you want to chair? Or shall I? Okay, about how long do you want to go? Right.
We'll take questions from the audience and some discussion if people would like to put any points to Professor Lewis. Not for a great amount of time, so we might have to limit discussion. If you could possibly keep your questions reasonably brief.
I was misinformed by somebody who claimed to be acquainted with both. He is not here, as a matter of fact. I'll name no names. Yes, there is a connection. And I think it might be this. I think that the thought that you expressed, or that you cited Russell as expressing, is a thought that someone might easily come to in a few steps. Step one, my premise, experience is the best teacher. Step two, there must be phenomenal information. There must be some kind of information we get when we experience a feeling, but not when we go to physics lectures. Step three, this is what I called, rather unkindly, parapsychological information. Information about the non-physical aspects of the causal order. As for computers, we know their physics in great detail. We may not know everything there is to know about their physics, just as a part of not knowing everything there is to know about physics generally, but we know enough to be quite sure that we don't need any extra parapsychological causal order to explain what computers do. And if that's right, then feelings are things about which there's phenomenal information. Phenomenal information is about the parapsychological aspect. Computers don't have a parapsychological aspect, therefore computers don't have feelings. I would say that there are two mistakes here. One mistake is to think that we need to accept the phenomenal information hypothesis instead of the ability hypothesis. The other is to assume that phenomenal information must be information about an extra part of the causal order, which we know doesn't show up in computers. So I think the relevance is that two of the things I was attacking as errors taken together would lead to the conclusion that computers can't have feelings.
I have two questions about the ability hypothesis. One is, could you say, why it is that, say, a being couldn't have the abilities without physicist learns and comes to experience for the first time when she goes out and sees things? And secondly, what would you say to the view that she acquires those abilities because she acquires something else? Granted, she has the abilities, but at least part of the explanation of why that is because she acquires something.
Sounds to me like one question put two ways, and it's something I was thinking about discussing if there'd been more time. The proposal is, let's see, I will pretend that you are an advocate of the proposal, though I know that really you're just asking me to comment on it. The proposal is to turn the tables on me. The proposal is this notion of knowing how, as distinct from possessing information, is a bit of a mistake. You see, one way we get to have abilities is to possess phenomenal information. And possession of phenomenal information gives us abilities that we couldn't get in any other way. And with varying levels of plausibility, you can tell that story about each of my examples. Not the knowing Lloyd George, that would still have to be treated as something different. But as for knowing how to wiggle the ears, one could imagine that if only you knew what it was like to wiggle your ears, if only you had the phenomenal information, then suddenly you could start wiggling your ears. The thing that hinders you from doing it is not knowing what it would be like to do it. Similarly, you could imagine that if only you knew what it was like to be a skilled user of chopsticks, presto, you'd be a skilled user of chopsticks. Most plausibly of all, and this one may even be, in a sense, right, I think, if you knew what it was like to see the shape of a C-38 locomotive, straightway you'd get the ability to recognize a C-38 locomotive by sight. So far, indeed, I think that what I've said is correct. Knowing what it's like to see one or to see a diagram of one, being able to imagine the shape of one, being able to visualize, and being able to tell them by sight quickly without doing a lot of measurements and geometrical calculation go together. And somebody who's trying to turn the tables on me might say, that's because, you see, just as getting some physical information is the necessary ingredient in the ability to open a combination lock, so getting some phenomenal information is the necessary ingredient in the ability to recognize a C-38 locomotive by sight, or maybe to use chopsticks skillfully or wiggle your ears. I used to think it was a standoff, but I don't think that anymore. Because if you use possession of phenomenal information as part of your causal explanation of abilities which are exercised in physical occurrences, when you say, hey, there's a C-38, or you eat with chopsticks, or you wiggle your ears, then the alleged phenomenal aspect of things has caused you to have phenomenal information, which has caused you to have an ability, which has caused physical things to move in ways they wouldn't otherwise have moved. Now the phenomenal aspect has a causal role in the physical world. Now we can describe it in terms of its causal role. That enables us to give lessons on it to the inexperienced, but it still won't enable them to learn what it's like to have the experience, so it wasn't really phenomenal information. So I don't think now that this attempt to turn the tables produces even a standoff. Then I misunderstood the first question so that it was in effect equivalent to the second. Take it again.
The abilities, at least many of the abilities that we say she would acquire, we could, or ask why do you suppose that she couldn't acquire those abilities, or that machine couldn't have those abilities, for example, without having seen the rats, having had the phenomenal acquaintance with the rats. Because unless you can something else as well, but there'd still be something lacking. Therefore, the ability wouldn't be sufficient, or it wouldn't be all there is to having the experience.
Why do I say that you get the package of abilities if and only if you know you come to know what the experience is like? Typically, by having the experience. Never by taking lessons, maybe conceivably by magic or surgery. Well, it seems to me, first, that the abilities really do account for the sort of performances that the knowing what it's like was supposed to account for, though it couldn't have accounted for them if it was possession of phenomenal information. It seems to me, second, that the package of abilities is acquired in just the circumstances in which we think the knowing what it's like is acquired. Now, I think that's the part you think is begging the question. But I don't think we have any independent grip on this concept, knowing what an experience is like, except by the role it plays in our common sense, half-systematic psychology. And the role laid down for it does include being acquired by and large in just such ways and not in just such other ways. So if it's true, or close enough to true, that the package of abilities is acquired in just such ways and not in just such other ways, that'll make the package of abilities fit the role. Now, if you ask me, do I think it's absolutely impossible to get the package of abilities in an abnormal way, say by doing the thing that we mostly can't do and somehow extracting it from your scientific information? I don't know that that's absolutely impossible. But I don't have to say that whatever knowing what it's like turns out to be has to fit the popular stereotype of knowing what it's like perfectly. Just well enough. And if you ask me, and finally this is what you really did ask me, unless I've misunderstood you again, why it's not possible to get to know what it's like without acquiring the abilities, or to acquire the abilities without getting to know what it's like, in order to consider such a possibility, I'd have to have a grasp on this notion of knowing what it's like independent of the grasp that I get from common sense psychology, and I don't have it. I think if I believed the theory of phenomenal information, that would give me an independent grasp on the notion of knowing what it's like, and that would put me in a position to conceive of the possibility of knowing what it's like without getting the abilities, or vice versa. But I don't believe that theory.
I've got a number of people who have indicated they'd like to contribute to the discussion. I'm going to be unfair in one quite distinct way, and I'm not going to take them in order. We're not going to have time for everyone who's indicated that they would like to ask questions. I'd love to make that time available to anyone who's not a Latrobe philosopher and isn't going to get a chance to ask Trevor Lewis a question any other time. Latrobe philosophers will get that chance. Chris? Sorry for that.
Professor, what is an instance of pure information? You seem to suggest that while most cases were mixed, there were cases.
A pure case of acquisition of information? Well, I think what I said was there are cases where acquiring an ability is entirely a matter of acquiring information. That was the kind of pure case. And coming to know something was entirely a matter of acquiring information. there wasn't any ability obtained over and above what could be explained by possessing the information. Well, my example was learning the combination of the lock and the bank vault. Learning, that is, that this lock is such that it would open if you turned it twice to the left to 14 and once to the right to 34 and so forth.
But I guess the question then comes, what makes it knowledge that it's this lock? Is that, can that be explicated as information?
There's a theme in the discussion, turns up in Nagel's BAT paper. I don't think it's very relevant, which I played down. I spoke of information as information about the world. But there's a kind of information which is information about my place in the world. Suppose that the world the history of the world consists of five exact repetitions. I could learn what the world is like, here are these five exact repetitions, and not know whether I'm the guy who plays a certain role in the first repetition, or the second, or the third, or the fourth, or the fifth. Okay. We can call this self-ascriptive information. I've called it desse information. Now, I could have gone through the whole argument saying at every step, physical information doesn't help, about the world doesn't help you know what it's like, and physical information about your own place in the world doesn't help either. I left that complication out. Now, I think that the impurity that you may be detecting in the case of information about the bank lock is that it isn't entirely information about the world. It's information that you might best express with a first-person pronoun, and also a present tense. The lock of the bank that is closest to me right now is such that it would open if da 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 da. So I don't think that's pure information about the world. I do think it's pure information. I do think it can be explained in terms of possible cases. I am a possible individual such that the closest bank has a lock with combination, etc. I am not a possible individual elsewhere in the world, or maybe in another possible world, whose closest bank has a lock with combination so and so. Pure information about the world? Compound with structural formula so-and-so can't be boiled because it decomposes before it gets to boiling point. How will that do?
I think with regret that we've run out. I'm sorry to people who still had questions. Could I ask you, before we thank Professor Lewis once again, do what I should have done before and welcome people who come from other universities and from anywhere else at all. And also ask you to join us after we've finished in a glass of wine and a few things to nibble out in the foyer. Thank you very much, Professor Lewis.
Thank you. I have actually got enough of a shortened draft that people who want it can have it. That's why I was late.